We think women need to talk more openly about money, because money really matters. It shouldn't be embarrassing or confusing. Join the conversation. We'll be discussing a whole range of topics which will help you get comfortable with your finances. Money Matters, brought to you by AJ Bell.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the AJ Bell Money Matters podcast. I'm Danny Hewson and with me is Laura Souter. Hi, Laura.
Hi there. So we are coming down from a bit of a high after meeting so many Money Matters listeners and new listeners. So welcome at the Anything Is Possible live event in Manchester. We had some great questions to our sessions and most of them were about how to actually start investing. So how to get going, what the basic checklist is you need to follow. So we're going to run through that. We've done some of these bits a bit more in depth on previous podcast episodes and articles. We'll signal them as we go throughout this episode, but we're going to go back to a bit of investing 101, I think.
Yeah, and with childcare being a really hot topic at the moment, with the government's funded hours coming in for two-year-olds, but we know lots of parents have struggled to find a provider. Others have found that the help just doesn't go anywhere near far enough to enable them to head back to work. We've drafted in the fabulous Jolie Brearley, founder of Pregnant Then Screwed, to pinpoint the shortcomings and to discuss what else needs to be done to end the motherhood penalty. This is incredibly real, the motherhood penalty. We've done lots of research on this. Our Financial Wobbly Bits report looked at some of the potholes that women tend to fall into when they reach certain points in their lives, which impacts their ability then to save, certainly to save for their pensions and retirement. And I know that lots of people always get in touch talking about when they go back to work, maybe they're not on the same kind of path that they were before, they're not earning as much. And it is a huge issue.
It definitely is. And interestingly, I was chatting to someone this morning about that. So she's her daughter's about one. She is at that stage of kind of going back into work. And she was just saying that kind of navigating the competing demands that you've got, the need to make money because children are so expensive, but also the want to stay at home and juggling making that money with nursery costs and childcare costs is huge, and kind of thinking about what you want to do in the here and now, but also where you want to be in 5-10 years time. And obviously what you do now in your working life will impact that decision and kind of what you're doing in future. So it's such a tricky balance to strike, I think.
It is. And I know certainly when I was starting out having my kids, there was a real feeling that our bosses were very much waiting for us to reach that point. So a lot of us felt like we were kind of treading water in terms of our careers and just got married and, you know, the expectation that you were going to go off and have kids. And most of us did, but some didn't. And they still felt that they were impacted by the motherhood penalty, even though they never had kids.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of view. And that kind of treading water in your career, either because you want to stay at a company that has good maternity benefits or because you're off on maternity leave or you've just come back. I think that is such a real thing if I think about my friends, but so hard to measure. It's very hard for us to kind of do research in that area and really get a measurement of how much women are impacted by that versus men, because I think it's not just that time off where you're having kids. It's also the time afterwards where you maybe think, oh, I've got, you know, a flexible employer here, or I can work flexibly, or all of these things factor into ultimately your career decisions, which then has a knock-on effect on the financial implications of it. So it's a huge, huge topic. And we know from, like you said, Danny, our Financial Wobbly Bits research, that this is one of those kind of hurdles where women's finances end up falling behind men's. And you can check out that research on our website, which is on ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk. And you can download the report there. And more than just offering up these issues and these hurdles, we've got a whole financial checklist and plan at the end of that report of how you can overcome this hurdle and some of the other ones as well that happen through life.
Yeah, and what was quite interesting is one of the people that we spoke to when we were conducting that report said one of the things that she would like to see, a young woman, was changes to the whole parental leave structure, because she felt that giving more paternity leave to men would help offset some of the issues that women face. And I spoke to Jolie about that. So do keep listening to this episode.
But before we hear from Jolie, let's crack on with a real beginner's guide to how to start investing. And the great thing is there are only four decisions that you need to make before you get started investing. So the first is what provider you're going to pick. Now, obviously, I would say you should pick one of the AJ Bell brands, but I'm going to be brand agnostic here and just say you need to look at the providers that are out there, what they offer, how much they cost, and what you need. So there's lots of kind of more simplified app-only investment platforms. They might offer a slimmed-down investment range, and that could be a great option if you're a real first-time investor. You can access them on your mobile, on an app, a bit like these kind of digital newcomer banks. So they can be a great option for first-timers. A slim down investment range, but that might be good if you don't want to be overwhelmed by choice. On the other side, there will be more kind of web-based providers or investment platforms, as they're called in the industry. They'll probably have an app as well, to be honest, because everyone has one of those these days, but it will have a much broader investment universe, is what we call it in the industry. So essentially that means it's got all of the options out there that you could invest with. And that is great for those people who want lots of options and want lots of choice. The kind of analogy that we typically use with this is, do you want the Tesco Superstore or do you want Tesco Express? Because both have a place, and sometimes you might want the Superstore to have that full range of lots of different products. Sometimes just that Tesco Express, where the choice is slimmed down and you can nip in and out and do things a bit more quickly, is a better option. Hopefully that analogy translates, but you really want to be looking at thinking about what you need, what kind of things you want to be investing in, and then also crucially look at charges, look at the cost of these things, because while somewhere might have, you know, a very whizzy app and have really good branding about it, you might be paying extra for that, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you just need to be aware of kind of weighing up the costs of these things. There's some good comparisons out there, either from kind of newspaper money sections, or people like Boring Money will do comparisons of investment platforms, which, for example, look for things like being a which recommended provider. But those guides of like, if you fit into this category, these platforms might be good for you. That's some good research to do.
I love that Tesco analogy, because we do like to boil things down to get rid of all the clunky jargon. I think that just works. Now we're moving on to step number two, and that is, what type of account do you want? Now, we've done a whole episode on the different types of account with our brilliant pensions and savings expert, Charlene Young. So this that we're about to do is a real whistle-stop tour. Do listen back to that episode if you want to do much more. But I would say that when you are choosing the type of account you want, tax is often a consideration. In fact, when isn't it a consideration? So if you can use a tax wrapper to protect your investment gains, then that is always a really smart first step. So if you're saving for something other than retirement, and I caveat that, then an ISA or a lifetime ISA might well be your first port of call. But the lifetime ISA, as I say, could also potentially be something that you use to save for retirement. So to get rid of the jargon, it's an individual savings account. You can save up to £20,000 a year in an ISA, £4,000 for a lifetime ISA. Now, that's not extra. That is part of your £20,000, something that catches people out. A lifetime ISA is only available if you're under 40 and you have to use the cash that you save into it for a first home that you are going to live in or until you are 60. There are all sorts of issues if you take your money out for something else. So do look at the small print there. Now, obviously, a pension's a common product. You can have more than one pension on the go at once. Lots of people have a whole boatload because they've had workplace pensions at every job they have ever had, and they've moved around a lot. And I'm not going to dwell too much on pensions because we've done a whole episode with Rachel Vay talking about pensions and pulling them all together into one pot. And finally, you could just go for a general investment or a dealing account. But with those, you need to be aware that you may have to pay tax on the money that you make on or above your capital gains allowance, which is just £3,000.
So that's a great coverall, I think, of the accounts. But like Danny said, we've got much more in-depth stuff on the Money Matters website, on previous podcasts, and you can do a bit of research on that. And then we come to decision number three, which is how are you going to fund it? So you've picked your investment platform, you've opened the right account to you, whether that's an ISA or a pension or a dealing account, and then you need to put some money in to get started so you can start investing. There's three different ways that you can do this. So you could put in a lump sum, so you just pay in money from your bank account, and then that will go into your investment account and you can start buying investments. The next option is to set up a direct debit. So in a similar way that you set up a direct debit to pay your bills each month, to pay your gas bill or your energy bill or whatever, you can set up a direct debit that goes into your investment account and does so every month. This is a really great way, I think, of being able to kind of set up investments, forget about them. It automates and happens in the background, so you don't have to remember to do it each month. And then you can check in with it every so often. And I think one of the barriers people think of when they think of starting investing is that they need a huge amount of money. But actually, you can set up a direct debit for as little as £25 a month to start investing, which is a great way to kind of build up your knowledge and experience and confidence with investing. And then the other option is you could transfer in an account. So this could be an existing ISA or pension that you've got. You could transfer that money from another provider into your account. And you can do a mixture of these two. So you might want to, you know, transfer in a previous pension, but also set up a monthly direct debit. So you just need to think about how you're planning on funding it and set that up.
And the last step you need to take is, what are you going to invest in? And there are four main areas to consider: multi-asset funds, funds, shares, and other things like investment trusts, bonds, property, or even handbags. That's one I like. Laura, do you want to take us on a quick tour of what each of those are?
Yeah, so I think let's start with shares, because I think that's where people tend to think of when they think of investing. They think of buying and selling individual shares. So this is why you buy a small bit of a company and you own that company and you hope that it goes up in value. This is some people's first route into investing, but actually it can be quite risky, because if you're not starting with a huge amount of money, it might be that you can only afford to buy one or two shares in different companies. And that means that a lot of your fortunes and all of your investment returns are pinned just to a couple of companies. And if they hit a rocky patch, or if their shares fall in value, that's going to have a huge impact on your portfolio. So it's a valid route in, but you just need to be aware of the kind of risk. The slightly less risky option, I would say, is opting for a fund. So this is where you're pooling money with other investors, and you're delegating to a kind of professional who goes and picks all of those investments. And it means that you get a bigger spread across lots of different investments, because you're pooling your money with other people. So you can effectively afford to own a little bit of lots of different companies for that same contribution. So it's a good way, A, of kind of outsourcing the investment decision. So you don't need to be going through company accounts and researching individual companies to pick those shares. But two, it's a good way of getting what we call in the industry diversification, but what is basically not putting all of your eggs in one basket. So that means if a fund owns, say, 100 companies, and one of them has a bit of a rough time and its shares fall in value, that's not going to have a dramatic impact on your overall investment pot. And you would hope that, you know, while that one maybe isn't doing so well, lots of others are doing well, and that over time, your money will rise in value. So that can be a really good option. A subsection of that, like you said, Danny, is multi-asset funds. So these are funds, you're still pooling it, you're still outsourcing it to a professional to make the decisions, but rather than just investing in shares in companies, they invest in other different, what we call asset classes as well. So that can include things like bonds, that can include gold, for example, property, maybe a real mixture of different things. And to that kind of diversification point of view, which I know is a little bit of jargon, but to spreading your eggs around lots of things, if you're not just investing in directly in companies, but you're investing in other things as well, then you would hope that that would give you a kind of smoother ride and see that your investment rises in value. That is such a whistle-stop tour through, and I'm conscious that that's a lot of information, but we've got a really great article on the Money Matters website, which is called What Are the Main Types of Investment? And that will talk you through all of those and some of the different options a bit more in depth, but very jargon-free, I promise you that.
And again, if you want more on what goes into one of those multi-asset funds that Laura was just talking about, then do take a listen to our podcast episode, How to Build an Investment Portfolio, because we've spoken to a woman that does build those portfolios. But we had so many questions about getting started. We just wanted to pull out the basics in a sort of really easy to understand jumping off point. And Laura, a lot of the questions that we got were also around when should people start investing? You touched on how much money they need to start with, and also should they pay off other debts first?
Yeah, so I think that's a really important question, because I think a lot of what we talk about is saying, you know, more women should invest. We know that there's this big gender investment gap, and we know that part of the reason there is for that is because women are prioritizing cash savings, for example, or other areas of life. So we're always saying get started now. But actually, there are a few things that you need to check before you get started investing. So the first would be to be paying off any expensive debt. So when we think about this, we think of kind of credit cards, overdrafts, any personal loans, things like that. We tend to set aside mortgages and student loans for this purpose. And it's just things where you're going to be paying that really high interest rate, like on credit cards. It's a good idea to pay that off before you start investing, because any investment return you make is going to struggle to generate such a high return that it kind of cancels out what you're paying on that debt. So a good idea to prioritize that. Then also think about cash savings. So lots of women we know like the safety of cash, and they are actually hoarding too much money in cash where they should be investing. But cash is still valid. You still need a pot of cash as your kind of emergency or rainy day fund. How much people have really depends on their own kind of risk tolerance and how much they feel comfortable with. Generally, we say around 3 months of expenses. So not your income, but actually your essential expenses. We're talking mortgage or rent, energy bills, food bills. Around 3 months of the cost of that should be what you have in cash. And then anything that you know that you're going to buy in the next 5 years, because we tend to think of investing being 5 years or longer. So if you know that you are, you know, hitting a milestone birthday and going to go on an epic holiday in a couple of years' time, keep that money in cash. Or that was a very like nice aspirational one that I think about. It's like probably slightly more boring if you know your boiler needs replacing in a couple of years' time and that's going to cost you a wodge of money, or you'll need a new car. Then keep that money to the side in cash. And then after that, you can really think about investing and putting some of that money to work harder for you.
Okay, that, as Laura says, is a complete whistle-stop tour, but we've hoped that we've whet your appetite a bit. We've given you something to think about. And as we say, do take a look at our Money Matters website. It is www.ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk, and there is loads of information on there. Hopefully something that can help you out with whatever you are interested in terms of getting started investing, your finances. And if there's something that isn't there that you would like to see there, do get in touch with us. You can email us hello@ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now, let's hear from our special guest this week. Jolie Brearley founded Pregnant Then Screwed not long after she had her first child, and she has been campaigning to end what is often called the motherhood penalty ever since. She says politicians are finally listening. They've realised that there is a vital economic need to keep parents, particularly mothers, in the workplace. But she says we are a long way from done. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us, because there's so much to unpack. Things over the past year have been talked about helping parents, particularly mums, back in to work. We're going to talk childcare and, you know, all sorts. But you've been fighting now for almost a decade to end the motherhood penalty. How are you feeling? Have things got better?
How am I feeling? I'm pretty knackered, to be honest, Emily. I've got bags that I didn't have 10 years ago and grey hairs that I didn't have 10 years ago. But I do have hope that things are improving. I mean, the motherhood penalty itself sadly hasn't improved. In fact, things have got worse. So we just did some analysis of data from the Office of National Statistics and found that the pay differential between mothers and fathers is £4.44 per hour. So mothers are paid £4.44 less per hour than fathers. And that amount had increased by £1 per hour since 2020. So sadly, things are not getting better in the sense that mothers are being paid less than they were. But it is on the political agenda. All of the different campaigns that we've been working on, when we started working on them, politicians would look at you like you had two chocolate fingers stuck up your nose. But now, things like issues like childcare are the hot potato for the next general election. So there is hope.
There is hope. But, I mean, you woke up to this because you had your own experiences with the motherhood penalty.
Yeah, I did. I was 4 months pregnant and I informed my employer that I was expecting, and the next day they sacked me by voicemail. And my employer was a children's charity. So it just goes to show how common this issue actually is, but I had no idea how common it was when it happened to me. I tried to do something about it. I got a lawyer. The lawyer wrote my employer a letter demanding I be compensated. My employer just threw that letter in the bin. They didn't even grace it with a response. And so I asked the lawyers what I should do next. And they said, well, you would take them to tribunal. I said, how much would that cost? And they said it would be about £9,000. I mean, I certainly didn't have £9,000 just sloshing around in my bank account waiting for a rainy day. So I said, thank you, I'll think about it. And then I discovered I was having a high-risk pregnancy. So I went to a routine doctor's appointment. They discovered my cervix had almost vanished. They told me I could go into labour at any point, and if I went into labour now, the baby would die. They rushed me into surgery, did this delightful operation where they sort of tried to staple my cervix together. And when I was in the recovery unit, the doctor said to me, stress has caused this problem, and what you've got to do now is reduce stress, because this operation may not work. It's only about 30% success rate, and if the baby comes in the next 2 to 3 months, there is a likelihood they will maybe not survive or have severe disabilities. So as you only have 3 months less 1 day to raise a tribunal claim from the point the discrimination occurs, I couldn't wait until he was born safely and then start proceedings. Thankfully, he was fine. He's now a very healthy 10-year-old boy. But because that opportunity for justice was taken away from me, and I was literally left with this choice of accessing the justice I deserved or protecting the health of my unborn child, the anger built and grew and grew and grew. And so it was 2015 International Women's Day, I woke up and thought, today I'm going to do something about it. And I, that day, taught myself how to use WordPress, and by the afternoon launched a website called Pregnant Then Screwed. And it was simply a place for women to tell their stories of discrimination, what was happening behind the closed doors anonymously. And that was really important, because if you experience discrimination, you are often forced to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which gags you from speaking publicly about your experience. And for others, even if they haven't been gagged, they don't want to be branded a troublemaker. So the anonymity of the website was crucial. The story started to build, and with that, people asked me for help and legal advice, and I was not a lawyer. I then met an employment lawyer who said she would help me. And you know, from there, we've now been going, as you said, for almost 10 years. And last year, we helped over 90,000 women with free advice and support.
I mean, almost 10 years, that many women coming to you. I would imagine sometimes it feels quite overwhelming. But the fact that, as you say, politicians have stopped looking at you as if you've got chocolate fingers stuck up your nose, that they are now paying attention, that must give you a degree of satisfaction. But what's the end game here? What would be utopia?
Utopia would be a place where there is no pay differential between mothers and fathers. And so in order to get there, to have equality in the workplace, you have to have equality in the home. There has to be an equal share of the unpaid labour as well as the paid labour. So that's critical to the work that we're doing. But also, utopia is about valuing care. So this isn't just about saying we need to get more people working. This isn't, you know, a big capitalist campaign for us all to be earning loads of money and getting into work. This is about the fact that we do not value the really crucial job that predominantly women do of caring for young people and old people. And so, you know, we see with the childcare sector that the staff are paid appallingly badly for this crucial, critical, hard job that they do. And it's the same in the social care sector. So we do have an issue in this country with the way that we talk about and value care. We just see it as fluffy, unskilled work that isn't all that important. And actually, without care, society would fall apart.
Let's dig in a bit to care, and specifically childcare then, because there's been an awful lot of noise. And it seems every day there's a lot of noise about the change to, and I'm going to call it funded childcare. I'm not going to call it free childcare, but extra funded childcare. And do you think that that has made a difference? Is this something which is available to everyone, or are there still big issues to deal with here?
When the Chancellor in the spring budget announced the additional $4 billion investment in childcare, I was elated. In fact, I had a cry. I was so happy. And I was elated because finally there was a serious commitment to childcare. And finally, childcare had been linked to economic growth, which is something we had been pushing. You know, that narrative was something we'd been pushing for years, to show that if you have a functioning childcare system, it boosts the economy. This isn't soft, fluffy investment. This is hard economics. The thing is, the way that that money has been spent in some ways is nonsensical. And, you know, if although the investment was ambitious, we really need to do a lot more if we actually want to make childcare work for the economy. Part of the problem is that not everybody can access those funded hours, as you've alluded to. So migrant parents have no recourse to public funding. They can't access any sort of childcare funding. Students can't access it. So if you're training to be a nurse or a teacher, you can't access any childcare funding, which is crackers, because we need more nurses and we need more teachers. If you earn under a certain amount, you can't access it, and over a certain amount, you can't access it. So there are lots of parents that are excluded from this funding. And the majority of parents on low incomes aren't really benefiting from many of the childcare schemes. And that is a big issue because we know that low-income families stand to benefit the most from an affordable, accessible, high-quality childcare system. Children do, children in low-income families do really well if they get early, good quality early years education. But also, of course, if you're on a low income, the only way you can dig yourself out of poverty is if you've got childcare. If you haven't got childcare, you've got no chance. So the way the money has been spent, we think is really inefficient. And we are working with the New Economics Foundation at the moment on a different childcare model, how you would spend that money differently so that it benefited more families. And what we would like to see is that no family pays more than 5% of household income on childcare, and that providers are receiving more money for the childcare that they're delivering, because at the moment they're scrapping around trying to find any pennies where they can to pay their staff and to provide high quality childcare. And of course that means the quality is reducing. So we're seeing quality reducing. We're seeing staff leaving in droves because they're not valued, they're not paid properly. So the whole system is still very unwieldy and still not sustainable. And of course that has a negative impact on parents and their ability to earn an income.
Yeah, I mean, you've done research, we've done research highlighting childcare and going back to work or trying to go back to work after you've had a child as one of the hugest issues for women in terms of their ability to pay into their pension pot, to continue up the career ladder, to achieve pay rises. But something else that one of our listeners spoke to us about was the fact that even when a woman is of childbearing age, because of the expectation that she may go off and have kids, employers still see women differently. And she would have liked to have seen the government actually do more to help expand parental leave. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. Paternity leave is one of the big keys to unlocking equality in the UK. So we have the worst paternity benefit in Europe. You get 2 weeks at £172 a week. It's absolute pittance. One in four dads and second parents don't even take their 2 weeks because they can't afford to do so. We did some research with the Centre for Progressive Policy looking at what happens in countries that have at least 6 weeks paternity leave paid at a decent percentage of salary. And we found that it reduces the gender pay gap by 4%. That's massive. 4% is huge. And it also reduces the labour force participation gap, i.e. you get more women in work and more women working longer hours. So paternity leave is critical. But maternity leave in this country is also terrible. And the government constantly say we have one of the most generous parental leave systems in the world. Nonsense, we don't. The maternity benefit we have is in the bottom three benefits in Europe. And that's because the time that we get, that we're allowed to take off up to 12 months is generous, but the amount of money that you get is very, very poor. So the majority of mothers cannot afford to take that full benefit because you get 6 weeks at 90% of salary, and then it very quickly drops off a cliff to £172 a week for the next nine months in total you get pay, and then it's 3 months at nothing. So many mothers can't afford, and they're returning to work a lot earlier. Now, the problem with that is, in terms of the economy, is that they return to work well before they're ready. So they're not performing often at the rate that they were before they left. And so employers look at them as if they're distracted and less committed to their job, as if they can't be bothered, they want to be at home with their children. And this is often when discrimination starts to kick in, because they think, oh, well, you know, they don't really want to be here. They get sidelined, they get demoted, often they get made redundant or pushed out. If we had a more generous parental leave system, Women would be more likely to return to work when they are ready, and they would be more productive. There would be lower rates of postnatal depression, but also dads would be taking much longer out of work to care for their children. And that would start to rebalance the unpaid care burden, because dads then would learn how to look after a baby, because it's a job, right? And it's really complicated. Like figuring out how to get your baby to sleep, whether how they want their toes cut, how to, you know, all of this stuff is stuff that you learn on the job. And because dads are often just pushed back to work straight away, they don't get that chance to learn, and they become the support act to the mum, and the mum is firmly in the position of main caregiver, and that continues throughout her life. So we really, paternity leave is such a critical part of rebalancing the books.
So changes to flexible working, which have come in because now you can ask for it from day one. If employers are able to do that, potentially that could be a really good thing for both mums and dads returning to work.
It could. The problem is that we know the majority of flexible working requests are made by women when they return to work. And the reason being, because as we've just talked about, parental leave mean that our current parental leave system means that women are nearly always the main caregiver. So when they return to work, they are the ones that are going to make the sacrifices. They're going to decide to go part-time so that they can pick their child up from nursery or rely less on the childcare system, or they're the ones that are going to ask for concentrated hours or whatever it is. Men are much less likely to ask for flexible working, and even if they do, they're more likely to be rejected. So this move to a day one right to request is a step in the right direction, but actually in terms of whether it's going to change the goalposts, I think it will make very little difference. The previous law was that you had to be in a job for 6 months before you could ask, but a right to request is still a right to decline. And we know that the majority of requests are declined. All you're doing is making that thing happen a bit faster, because it happens on day one rather than 6 months after you've been in the job. What would have made a difference is if the right to request was from job offer rather than the first day of the job, because then you were off the job and you could say, okay, well, these are the terms under which I'd like to work. Is that acceptable to you? And you could both decide as an employer and an employee whether that was going to work out. Sadly, the government decided not to do that, and I still have no idea why. And what we've been campaigning for is for all jobs to be advertised as flexible by default. In other words, if you can make your job flexible, then you would stipulate that in the job advert, and you have to have a very good business reason why you can't make that job flexible. So when people are applying for jobs, they know what flexibility is available. And we know from other companies that have done this, when they advertise jobs as flexible, the number of applicants they get increases by about 30%, and often very senior women start applying for those roles. So it's good for the business and it's good for employees.
We're in an election year. Politicians are listening. There have been changes. Some clearly haven't gone as far as you would have liked them to go. There are still avenues that can be pursued, walk down. What would you like to say to politicians of every colour that are about to go on the doorstep? And what would you like to say to all those women answering the doors to the politicians about the questions they should be asking right now?
They should be asking about childcare reform and parental leave. What are you doing to make our childcare system affordable, accessible, and high quality? What exactly are you going to do to get us there? And they should be asking questions about parental leave and whether they will be pushing for an increase in parental leave pay and for an increase in time for paternity leave as well. Those are just the two. If we can change childcare and parental leave, I mean, it will make just the biggest difference to parents. There, of course, are many other issues. Those aren't the only issues. I'm not going to pretend they are. And I'm not going to pretend that if we fix those, we fix the motherhood penalty, because we don't. But it absolutely moves us a big leap forward. So those are the two issues I'd like to hear people raise on the doorstep.
So we're running out of time. The one thing that we always like to do on this podcast is compile sort of a checklist a sort of handy guide for people who are thinking about having kids or having more kids. Are there a sort of top three things you could say that you could do to try and give yourself the best shot of not getting screwed after you're pregnant?
I would say to any woman, know your rights at work. You really need to know what you're legally entitled to and what is okay for your employer to do and what isn't. Because if you know your rights and they try to push you out, to demote you, the bullying, harassment that starts to happen, if you know your rights and you show them you know your rights, that what we find often is that that stops, the discrimination stops because they realize they can't mess with you. So know your rights, show them you know your rights. And if you still come unstuck, give us a call. We've got advice lines and we can help. And make sure you contact ACAS as well, because they can also help you. Secondly, until you have a baby, you will not understand how important childcare is to your life. It's so important for every element and aspect of your existence. So check out your local childcare options, build your community, because you'll be very reliant on friends. And if you can live close to family who will be active in your child rearing, then do so, because, you know, a active grandparent is so helpful in those really tricky situations and will reduce your childcare bill enormously. Lots of people, of course, don't live close to family now, but if you do, then well done. You're in a much better position than I was. And finally, I mean, I've got a book that is a great guide for how to get through many of those issues. That's called The Truth About the Motherhood Penalty and How to Fix It. So buy the book and read it.
That was the wonderful Jodie Brearley from Pregnant Then Screwed. Do get in touch with your experiences of accessing those funded hours. And you can find Jodie on social media. She's at pregnant_then_screwed on Instagram, or just at pregnant_screwed on X, and Pregnant Then Screwed on Facebook. And as Jodie says, you can find her book in all good bookstores. Now, Danny, did she have a confession?
She did have a confession. And Laura, this one really struck a chord with me, and I reckon it's likely to resonate with lots of our listeners.
Okay, so my confession probably would be that outside of working, my hobby is Vinted. I spend just an inordinate amount of time on the Vinted app, scrolling through clothes obsessively. And the thing is, I very rarely buy anything. I probably buy something about once every 6 months, but I probably spend about 2 hours a day on the app. And what I tend to do is I like things. So I go through it and I think, oh, that's lovely. And I like things. And then I sort of passively aggressively wait for them to offer me something rather than me saying I would pay this for it. And then that, you know, if they don't offer me something, I get really cross about it, even though they've no idea that that's what I'm sitting and waiting for them to do. And then when somebody buys the item that I had absolutely no intention of buying, I then feel really upset and really sad that I've lost this item I had absolutely no intention of buying. So my advice would be just steer away from Vinted, because ultimately it makes you deeply unhappy if you use it like I do.
All these secret Vinted conversations going on that nobody's got a clue about.
You know, Vinted conversations I'm having in my own head, which nobody has access to.
I must admit, I spend far, far, far too long on Vinted. I think I'm wedded to it. I can't give that one up.
Yes, definitely. I am guilty of doing that. Just the scrolling, the liking, waiting for it to come down in price, never really end up buying it. Yes.
I can spend hours on there, but my daughter has gone one step further, because she sells a lot of stuff on Vinted and Depop. So she's quite the little entrepreneur. But yeah, it can suck hours of my time. Although I have actually hit the buy button and got a couple of brilliant deals on some clothing that I really liked. So yeah, it is good, but a time suck and a money suck sometimes.
But thanks so much for listening to this episode. And thanks again to the hundreds of people that came along to the Anything Is Possible event in Manchester. It was so great to talk to so many of you, and keep an eye on our socials and our website for details of our future in-person and also online events that we're planning. And if you're already signed up to our newsletter community, we'll pop those details over in an email every month so you don't miss anything.
And we always love to hear from you on our social media platforms, especially if you've got questions, suggestions of topics you want us to address, or guests that you want us to chat to. And we have some brilliant guests coming up over the next couple of months. So do subscribe to the podcast wherever you found this one.
Yes, and I don't want to give too much of a teaser, Danny, but let's just say we've got a fabulous guest dancing her way onto the podcast in the coming weeks.
That's a nice tease. I like that.
But until then, thanks a lot for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.